Now, if you drive south from Lake Tahoe, you'll have spectacular scenery ahead of you, and eventually you'll be in California's Death Valley. Drivers there, as in many places, have traded in paper maps for GPS, but in such remote places, an over-reliance on satellite navigation can be a matter of life and death. Chrissy Clark of member station KQED explains.
I'm standing in Death Valley, where each summer, yes, summer, a 250,000 tourists pry themselves from air-conditioned cars into 120-degree heat to snap pictures of glittering salt flats. They come from Japan, from Chile, from Holland, from Florida. Different accents, same traveling companion, suction-cupped to the dashboard.
GPS.
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 The GPS.
GPS.
We named her Nell.
Whatever you call her, she's got an offer that's hard to refuse.
Select destination.
But when dozens of abandoned dirt roads lie between you and that destination, things between you and Nell the GPS can get tricky. That's what Donna Cooper of Pahrump, Nevada, discovered last July on a day trip to Death Valley.
D-E-A.
After a long day, Cooper and her family asked Nell the GPS for the shortest route back home. And in that confident voice, those magic words.
Please proceed to the highlighted route.
But what came next did not compute.
Go 550 feet and turn right. Well, at 550 feet, it was like a little path. And then,
please proceed to the highlighted route.
Go a quarter of a mile and turn left. There was nothing there. She had me running in circles for hours and hours and hours.
Death Valley Ranger Charlie Callaghan says Donna Cooper is not the only visitor who's relied on GPS and been seriously lost. It happens a couple times a year now.
And they'll usually volunteer it themselves. You know, it's like the GPS told me to go this direction.
Callaghan's been asking himself, what exactly is going on? Why is GPS going astray? Then he had an idea. To explain, he drives me out to a lonely corner of the valley.
Ah, ooh. Did you see that?
Yes.
A line has just popped up in the corner of my GPS screen. Supposedly, it represents a road about to intersect the one we're driving on. But out the window, there is no other road, just desert.
So that road there no longer exists. It's been probably 40 years, but somebody ended up driving on it because it showed up on their GPS.
Two summers ago, a mother and son on a camping trip had GPS in their car and got stuck on an abandoned mining road for 5 days.
She barely survived. The boy did not survive.
Callaghan wondered if part of the problem was that out here, GPS companies might be relying on old maps with roads that have long been closed. To test his theory, he went online and checked if the road where the little boy died was on any of the maps used by major GPS companies like Google Earth or Navtech or TomTom.
And it was there. I'm not sure if I could use the words that I thought. I mean, I was kind of like, this isn't right. Something needs to be done.
Okay, so yeah, click on our little area that we're working in.
That's when Callaghan got in touch with Matt Rinaldi. He helps maintain road data for TomTom. Together, they combed through the company's maps.
If I'm going to delete a road, I would cross with a red color and take the section of the road out.
In the end, they changed or deleted more than 150 roads in Death Valley. Now Callaghan's working to update maps for Navtech and Google Earth, too. But, he points out, at the root of these mishaps in the desert is something much older than GPS technology. In 1849, Death Valley got its name when a wagon train from the east tried to find the shortest route to California and got lost.
Somebody had a map and somebody said, this is a faster way to get to the gold fields. And deep down back in their brain, the common sense says, you know, this is not the wisest thing.
As for Donna Cooper's family, 3 days after they got lost, a search and rescue helicopter found them. Everyone survived, except Nell, the GPS, though that's not what Cooper was calling her by then.
Called her a few names, a couple four-letter words.
And yet, Cooper has not lost faith. She has a new GPS now, named Rosie.
You have arrived.
For NPR News, I'm Chrissy Clark.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, could Detroit be the new Brooklyn? After years as a symbol of urban decay, Detroit has become a destination for young artists and entrepreneurs. We'll hear from a new generation that's bringing a spark to the Motor City. We'll have that conversation in a few minutes. But first, if Twitter can transform how we talk to each other, can it change how our leaders debate? The first ever presidential debate on Twitter was held yesterday, hosted by a group called the Tea Party. .net. Six Republican candidates traded tweets on everything from the debt ceiling to jobs to find out who was in and who was out and how well it works to debate in 140 characters or less. We're joined once again by Mary Kate Carey. She's a former presidential speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's now a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She's a regular on our program. She's here in Washington, D.C. Also with us, Jordan Rayner. He's the vice president of communications for Engage D.C. That's a group that handles social media strategy for Republican candidates. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Kate, I'll start with you. Let's talk about who participated and who didn't. And does it say anything about, you know, who was in and who was out?
The ones who participated were Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and then two that I was not familiar with, Congressman Thad McCotter and former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson. The ones who did not participate were Romney, Ron Paul, and John Huntsman. Oh, and Tim Pawlenty. And so I don't think it matters that much who was there and who wasn't, because I kind of doubt they're going to do this again.
And Jordan, what about you? Does it matter? And didn't your firm has advised Tim Pawlenty, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And no, I mean, at this stage in the debate, candidates pick and choose the debates they want to participate in. You know, it's interesting, the two candidates that have widely been considered leading online, Romney and Pawlenty. There was a piece this week about Romney's ad spend being higher than any other candidate in the race. And there was a piece last week about Pawlenty's use of social media and his tweet note address about American jobs. I don't think it really matters. I don't think it's a reflection of where these campaigns are online. But it was interesting to see the candidates that did show up and watch this unfold in real time.
Well, so Jordan, just stick with us for a minute there. What is the value of this kind of experience?
The value is, I believe, to the voters in being able to, for an hour and a half, have access to potentially the next president of the United States and be able to ask questions directly of them. Now, we can debate, you know, the format in which questions were selected and how these questions rose to the top, which I'm sure we'll get into. But,
yes.
This is the democratization of information, right? We're living in it every day and having open access to politicians. Now, it's up to the politicians themselves as to whether or not they choose to engage with individuals and individual citizens. But, it is an important milestone. You know, we had Twitter at the White House a couple weeks ago, and having questions of real people asked of the president of the United States. And now we're having questions posed by real people to potential presidents of the United States. And that's an exciting thing.
So, Mary Kate, what were some of the standout moments for you?
Oh, there
were so many. You had them all, actually.
It was
you were telling
rich.
Me that you were just laughing your head off.
Well, for those of you
She's
who
still laughing her head off.
were unable to join us yesterday, the setup was on the left side of the screen, there were questions from the moderators to the candidates. And on the right side of the screen, there was an ongoing live feed of comments and questions from the public. And the good news was the questions were good. I think I agree with you, Jordan, that that's a valuable thing. And I think it was valuable that there was a Pew survey from 2008. 7 out of 10 people online these days are under the age of 35. And I think that was what was going on here, was they were trying to capture that crowd. The problem was that the site got overwhelmed. And so as the candidates were trying to respond, there would be incredible slow periods and then all of a sudden a rush of tweets that you couldn't read fast enough. One commenter said it was the most ADD experience she'd ever had in her life. Then you'd sit and wait and wait and wait. And somebody else wrote in and said, hey, I just finished making my ship in a bottle. How about you guys? And then as the answers came in, they were too short. Obviously, there were 140 characters. So there was no room for nuance or gray matter or anything like that. There was a lot of what we would call dog whistling, where people were putting stuff in, like Newt Gingrich had one about getting rid of the Fed. And I thought that was clearly throwing a bone to the Ron Paul supporters, because Ron Paul wasn't there. There was comments about how this increases the hyperbole instead of restraining it. And I thought that was a very wise comment. There would be questions like, how do we prevent the debt ceiling from being raised repeatedly? Be specific. Well, come on, you know. there was way too much opportunity for mischief on the right-hand side of the page. John Stewart was actually tweeting in. People with names like Harry Potter, Frodo Baggins. Somebody alerted everyone that Weird Al Yankovic was on over at Yo Gabba Gabba. You know, this kind of stuff. And the final problem was you didn't know if it was really them tweeting because you can't see them.
That's a good point. And, well, Newt Gingrich actually showed a picture of himself because he wanted to show that it was indeed him. But as we know, pictures – We won't get into what can happen with pictures.
There was an interview with him afterwards. There was a live webcast interview as soon as it was over. And I caught the end of it, and the moderator, who's one of the moderators of this, said, hey, Newt, if people want to follow you, what's your Twitter address? And he goes, I don't know what my Twitter address is.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that makes me question everything I just read if the guy doesn't even know his Twitter address.
I know. How about that, right? If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the first ever Twitter debate for presidential candidates. It took place yesterday. It was among the Republican candidates, not the whole field, but a good, you know, part of it. Joining us are Mary Kate Carey, columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. Also with us, Jordan Rayner of Engage DC. That's a firm that advises Republican candidates on social media strategy. So, Jordan, what were your highlights and lowlights?
Yeah, it was interesting to watch. The number one thing that stuck out to me was how incredibly slow the opening remarks were. I kept track of it, and between opening statements and closing statements, which were obviously pre-prepared tweets from these candidates, it took up 50 of the 90 minutes of this quote-unquote debate. It was really disappointing. I've managed stuff like this before where you're doing these sort of Twitter interviews, and it is always slower than you would expect it to be. But I would have hoped that the parties putting together this debate would have done a little bit more research and taken that into account because, I mean, more than half of the debate was, you know, pre-prepared remarks, which was, you know, a little bit unfortunate. You know, and then on top of that, we only got to 6 direct questions of the people. So they broke the format into 2 sets of questions. One were general questions open to all the candidates, and there was this great free-for-all of all these candidates trying to jump in and get their voice heard on these issues, which that was fun to watch. So that was a highlight for me. And then there were these specific questions from individuals on Twitter who were able to ask questions and then they directed them at specific candidates. We only got to 6 of those questions in an hour and a half.
Right.
So it was a little disappointing. I will say, though, you know, one of my concerns
not
going
being able
to debate,
ask enough questions because your guests have too much to say. Gee. When does that ever happen?
Right.
But I digress. But go ahead, Jordan, you were saying.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
You know, it was I was worried on the front end before the debate that the only questions that we're going to get asked were by really influential Twitter accounts, people that had more than 1,000, 2,000 followers. That wasn't the case. Mm-mm. Out of the 6 people whose questions were asked, they had an average of 546 Twitter followers, which was a pretty good number. Like I was impressed with that. So that was neat.
So you're saying that I don't like this term, but I can't think of another one at the moment.
Sure.
Real people actually did get to ask questions. It wasn't
kind of
a directed experience. It really was more of a free-for-all, which is ironic because you
weren't sure it was really the candidates. Like, you know, Michelle Bachmann's name was Team Bachmann, which made you think every time a question came up, she would like yell out to a bullpen of 20-year-olds, hey, how do I say this in 140 characters?
But that's really the way people govern, though. I mean, is it really that important that they be doing this themselves? Because really, then, you know, you have a team. That's how you govern, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't do the White House by yourself.
Sure, but I do think, you know, when you compare the word debate is, you know, in terms of Twitter, will instantly be compared to television. And on television, there aren't staff there. It's just the candidate on stage. And there's the potential, you know, they have to come up with the answer themselves on the spot. You know, I would have loved to have seen a candidate. I'm not sure why one of these candidates didn't do this. Have a live feed of video of them sitting in front of the computer answering these questions on their website. Like that would have been really interesting to see.
Good point. Anyway, so finally, before we let you go, inevitably after a debate, people ask, you know, who won or who lost or who, which isn't, I don't know how useful a question that is, but there is always the question of who impressed, who made an impression, who really took advantage of the experience. Does either of you think that any of these candidates did particularly well at taking advantage of the experience of making a strong impression?
I would say
– I think –
Newt Gingrich probably had the best substantive in a concise answer. But the one who did the best on this was President Obama in his Twitter town hall because he didn't tweet back 140-character answers. He had answers with thousands of words in them. And that seems to be a much better way, tweeting the questions, but let the answers be regular. And at the end of his, he had 30,000 new followers on Twitter at the end of the Twitter town hall. This one, the biggest winner was Michelle Bachmann, got 619 new followers. This wasn't winning people over. Mm.
Jordan, what do you think?
Well said, Mary Kate. I would agree with that. You know, I'm looking strictly at the data. You know, Herman Cain had the most retweets, so the most people that were just repurposing his content to their own personal following. And Michelle Bachmann was the most mentioned, which I don't think was surprising. Michelle Bachmann has a very engaged base of Twitter followers, and she generates a lot of buzz. So it wasn't a surprise to me that those two kind of generated the most buzz on the social web. So, you know, looking at strictly data, I would say those would be your two winners of the debate.
Although they came in with the most followers to start with.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So they didn't lose anybody.
They didn't lose anybody.
No.
So you guys, did you guys tweet this?
Not yet. I will be later this afternoon. The one I liked was history called in. It will not be including this in its files.
Mary Kate Carey is a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She's also a former presidential speechwriter. She was kind enough to join us once again in our studios in Washington, D.C. Jordan Rayner is the vice president of communications at Engage D.C. That's a firm that consults with Republican candidates on online strategy and social media strategy. He comes to us from member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Michelle.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Why is it when you go to the grocery store, you can find a dozen kinds of apples? You got your Macintosh, your Red Delicious, your Granny Smiths. You got other varieties of fruit like your tangerines, your tangelos, your mandarin oranges, your red and green seedless grapes. Big variety there. But there's only one kind of banana. There are thousands of varieties of bananas. But the big U.S. banana suppliers grow only one that we can get, the Cavendish. So that's the one we eat, and we eat a lot of them, billions and billions of pounds each year. We slice them on our oatmeal and our cornflakes. We whip them up in smoothies. We rely on them as a backbone of the banana split. But could our favorite fruit soon become history? Well, a lethal fungus is spreading through Cavendish banana plantations in Asia and Australia. What happens if it makes its way to Latin America, where the U.S. banana supply is grown? Joining me now to talk more about it is Dan Coppell, science writer and author of Banana, the Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. He joins us from KPCC. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
Is it true that the song, Yes, We Have No Bananas, was written because of a shortage of bananas once?
Well, the original banana that Americans came to know was called the Gros Michel banana, and that one was wiped out by a blight between 1906 and 1960. That song appeared in the 1920s, and it's likely that there were banana shortages during that time. I can't say that the writers of the song were aware of this, just like most people aren't aware of it now, but I would like to believe that it had something to do with it, and it's not a complete myth.
And you say that just like the Gros Michel bananas were wiped out by a disease, that we may be headed toward another wipeout.
Correct. That disease that killed Gros Michel, which was actually a better-tasting, better banana than what we eat now, the Cavendish, was called Panama disease. It's a fungal wilt. And in fact, what's killing Cavendish is another version of that very same disease. Cavendish was adopted because it was resistant to the original version of Panama disease, but it is not resistant to this newly discovered strain, and that's a big problem.
So why, as I mentioned in my introduction, we have all these varieties of other fruits and vegetables. Why do we only have one banana to choose from?
Well, I like to answer that by asking, why don't we have filet mignon, pad thai, and tofu scrambles at McDonald's?
Okay.
The banana is the cheapest fruit in the supermarket, and that's pretty weird because it is shipped from great distances, and It requires a lot of handling and refrigeration, much more than apples, for example. To do that, the banana industry has, for 100 years, had a business model that focuses on a single product. That's the McDonald's comparison. And I like to tell people, imagine a pipe from Ecuador to your supermarket that can only fit one variety of the world's 1,000 banana varieties. And that's basically the way it works. That's why bananas are so cheap. In order to bring new bananas, you have to build entirely new infrastructure, ranging from plantation to shipping to packing methods and to ways to tell consumers about it.
But you would think that the banana people who control the banana flow would know that there is a fungus among us out there someplace and headed in our direction.
Well, they know. They didn't admit it for a long time. Just a couple of years ago, Chiquita started talking about it. And Chiquita also has been doing some work on developing alternate varieties. But for the most part, the history of the industry has been to look at chemical means of control for blight. And to stick to this monocultural business model, because that's all they know. And in some ways, you can think of them as maybe the old department stores of the 1970s or Digital Equipment Corporation, some of these hidebound tech companies that couldn't change and disappeared. I'm not predicting Chiquita will disappear, but they're stuck in this century-old business model, and they have a really difficult time thinking about things any differently.
Is there any niche here for someone to get in with a different variety of banana then?
You know, I tell people every single day that if you want to get into a possibly lucrative business, because the banana is the most popular fruit in the supermarket and the world, look into importing new bananas. That said, it is a daunting task because each banana ripens differently, each banana ships differently, each banana has to be grown differently. You need sort of industrial strength, capital, and know-how to get that product. But that said, the kiwi fruit was unknown about 20 years ago and was introduced and is now pretty popular. So there's know-how, and if someone was willing to invest, I think it could happen.
You know, when you go to the store, you can. And if you go to other countries or in the Caribbean, Latin America, well, in the stores, we see plantains, or plantains, depending on how you want to produce it, say it. And then there's these little finger-shaped bananas. Are they, you're saying they're not different from the Cavendish bananas?
They are different, and some of them are susceptible to these banana diseases. There's about a dozen pretty virulent diseases. There are a few alternate varieties. We have a pretty good selection in Los Angeles because of our large Filipino population, but those varieties account for a statistical zero in terms of the Cavendish market share. And the banana companies have not had a lot of success with what they call the baby finger bananas. One of the reasons is that educational component in bringing in a new variety. Baby bananas need to be served much more brown than a traditional Cavendish to taste right. But most people are used to that visual cue that Cavendish gives, and so don't allow them to go brown. And that's been a real problem in getting people to actually like this variety.
How many of these varieties have you actually tasted, and how different are they?
I've tasted about, I'd say, 100 different banana varieties all over the world.
Wow. You got a favorite?
Absolutely. My favorite is called Ibota Ibota. It's a variety found, I discovered it or tasted it first in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ibota Ibota, the word Ibota means fertile in Swahili, and this banana yields huge bunches. And so it's called Fertile Fertile. It's so fertile. And it is absolutely delicious. It has, you know, you could only describe it the way you describe a really interesting wine. It's got complex taste. It's got notes and colors to it. But unfortunately, it doesn't have the proper characteristics for import. And it's too bad because it's a revelation. Our Cavendish banana is a lousy banana. In India, the world's largest banana growing country, they call the Cavendish the hotel banana.
Wow. And there's no way to get us closer to that banana, did you say it was in the Congo? It was growing over there?
In the Congo, there's similar varieties in Thailand. I wouldn't say there's no way. I would say that it will take creativity and guts.
Why not grow it locally? Tell it what prevents it from importing it. Does a banana have a range of temperature and humidity and things like that it needs to grow?
There are about 30 categories that the banana or 30 check marks that the banana industry has come up with to make a suitable import banana, one of which is that it can be grown in the regions where they operate. Definitely can't be grown up here in the U.S. But other ones include height of the tree, because banana growing countries are susceptible to hurricanes, so you want a lower tree. One includes how it indicates ripeness. Some bananas don't actually turn yellow when they ripen. And for Ibota, the problem is something called finger drop. Each banana fruit that we eat is actually known as a finger. And the problem is when you touch these wonderfully huge bunches of 20 or 30 of these bananas, all of the bananas fall off and their skin is torn and exposed, and you can't ship a banana that's already been opened. And that's the problem with Ibota.
But if you live there, it's easy to get it off the plant then.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, that could be a good thing if this is a village banana in the Congo and you've got a bunch of people relying on this one tree, then, yeah, right. It's like a flip-top can. So, yeah, it works pretty well.
How certain is it that the fungus that's not in the Caribbean yet is going to get to Latin America?
Well, I'll say, first of all, that this is my opinion, and I will also say that this is backed up by most people in science who know, but it is not backed up by Chiquita and Dole who say we don't know when. The truth is we don't know when. The problem is that this disease is so virulent that it could come tomorrow. It's transmitted via no more than a speck of dirt on a shoe or a tool. Now, if I was in a place like the Philippines where the disease exists and I had some dirt on my shoe and I landed in Costa Rica and stepped on a banana plantation, that's the beginning. So it could come in 20 years, but it could come tomorrow. It's like one person who's sick wandering around the earth and you don't know when he's going to open your door, but as soon as he does, you're finished. That's the way it'll work.
Yeah, so it's that simple. So it's something that lurks in the soil. It lives in the soil.
Correct. It lives in the soil, and that randomness. The banana industry likes to say, "Well, it's a long way away because it's not here yet, and it takes a while." In fact, they need to prepare right now because it could come tomorrow. It's not a long way away or a short way away. But if you know a disaster is coming. Mm-hmm. And like out here in LA, we prepare for earthquakes because we don't know if the big one's going to happen today or tomorrow or in 10 years, but we want to be ready.
Could you genetically engineer a better banana so it's not susceptible to this fungus?
Yes, and there's been quite a bit of good work involved in that, mostly done in Australia through a Gates Foundation grant. And there has been some success, but we don't know for sure how well these bananas will perform in the field in large scale. In addition, Chiquita and Dole and the other banana companies have promised never to sell a GMO banana. And in Europe, for example, you can't even sell a product like that. So whether you're going to solve that problem through genetic modification, which I'm in favor of, you may never have a commercial variety that can actually hit store shelves.
One quick question from Judith in Chico, California. Hi, Judith. Quickly.
Yes, I buy short, fat, red bananas at my local food co-op. Are these something that are also going to be threatened by this fungus?
Not this fungus. Those bananas, those red bananas, which is what we call them, are a relative of a really great banana called a Philippine Lacatan. And those are wonderful, wonderful bananas. They're available at places like food co-ops or Whole Foods, not generally in regular supermarkets. One of the problems with those bananas is that they're quite fragile. It's hard to ship them in the quantities needed to satisfy the American banana appetite, which is about 25 pounds of bananas a year without damage and extraordinary handling measures. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be a gourmet item, and they are really good.
Well, thank you, Dan. You've set out the alarm bells here for everybody to watch out for.
You're
this.
Most welcome.
Dan Capel is a science writer and author of Banana, the Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Great read. He joined us from KPCC in California. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you want to follow Dan, you can read his latest story about bananas in today's issue of The Scientist.
Here are the results from a big nationwide auto race. Last month, the Nissan Leaf pulled ahead of the Chevy Volt. In the first half of this year, Nissan sold 4,134 Leafs in the U.S. Chevy sold 2,745 Volts. Just as a basis for comparison, during the same 6 months, Toyota sold 147,469 Camrys. In fairness, the competition among the Volt, the Leaf, and the Tesla Roadster is supposed to be a race among tortoises. The finish line is somewhere in the future when plug-in electrics might wean us off our national petroleum habit. But we thought we'd check back to see if those modest sales figures are seen as encouraging. And joining us is Jerry Hirsch, an automotive industry reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Do automakers look at those numbers and say, yes, it's coming along, or this is a very slow market?
They say it's coming along. They can actually sell about as many as they could produce. What's probably holding the market back at this point is that Nissan and Chevrolet are ramping up production of those vehicles. So it's going to take some time to get to the point where they can make more than the market can absorb.
The Chevy Volt is a more expensive car, the Nissan Leaf. Are people springing for $40,000? Of course, they get a tax rebate in there, but are they spending that much and why?
Well, there is a huge passion among some people in the United States for electric vehicles. And the automakers could probably sell 50,000, 70,000 vehicles at these prices just because these individuals believe that electric vehicles are the future. They have environmental views that make them think that this is the best way of going from point A to point B. The big question is what happens when the incentives fall off? What happens when there's more entrants into the market, as there will be later this year and next year? Then we're really going to see how big is the market for electrical vehicles in the United States.
And I gather, by the way, one other spur to the market is that an electric car, or for that matter, a hybrid, is a ticket to the high-occupancy vehicle lane on the highway, so it can get you where you're going faster.
In California right now, it's actually just an electric vehicle or a zero or a low-emissions vehicle like a natural gas vehicle. Interestingly, the Volt does not qualify to get either the special rebate for electric vehicles in California or a California carpool lane permit. They're doing some re-engineering of that vehicle, and probably mid-2012 model year, it will qualify for those benefits.
Well, what's the outlook, say, for next year in terms of new competition in the electric vehicle market?
Well, one of the vehicles that I'm really watching is the Toyota RAV4 Electric. What's interesting about this, so this is a car that they've developed jointly with Tesla, and it has some qualities and characteristics that may make it attractive to buyers. One, it's a small SUV, so you're going to be able to haul more stuff in it. Two, it's expected to have a little bigger range. The Volt, for practical terms, you can get 40, maybe 45 miles. The Leaf, the best I've ever done with a single charge on a Leaf is about 78 miles. But the RAV4 has the potential to have a longer range because Tesla uses a little different battery system than these other manufacturers. So if they could bring this in at about the same price point, and we don't know that yet, it may grab sales from some of the existing vehicles just because it's a bigger vehicle with a larger range. And I think consumers are going to like that.
Jerry Hirsch of the Los Angeles Times, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, personal cybersecurity. And first, passwords. Almost everyone has got one or two or maybe 10, but passwords are vulnerable and perhaps not the best way to protect your digital identity. As we hear from NPR's Hanzi Lo Wang, computer scientists have been trying to crack the code on the next generation of passwords, and one researcher says all you may need is a squirrel.
I'm Rocky. Rocky the Flying Squirrel.
No, not that squirrel, just a squirrel. Then security expert Marcus Jacobson says, just imagine.
Maybe you went jogging in the forest and you stepped on a squirrel.
Oops, sorry, Rocky. But Jacobson says that's one way to create a strong password.
Think of a story. Turn it into three important words of the story.
And instead of punching in a random series of characters on a computer or a smartphone, users just need a three-word combination from a story they will remember. Jacobson says the more bizarre...
Jogging, forest, squirrel.
The less likely a hacker will be able to get into your account, and the more likely you'll be able to remember it. That's a good thing, because technology writer Clive Thompson says our memories are lousy.
Everyone knows that they should have a password that is harder to guess. But the truth is, we humans are pretty bad at remembering characters that make for a really strong password.
How bad are we at passwords? Well, earlier this month, Hotmail announced new email users will be banned from using passwords like, well, password, 123456, and... I love cats. Weak or even non-existent passwords were at least partly to blame for security breaches of voicemail accounts in the recent UK phone hacking scandal. There are other options for authentication. Ed Felton is chief technologist for the Federal Trade Commission, and he says security researchers group all the different ways a user can prove his or her identity into three categories.
Something you know, like a password, something that you have, like some kind of an object or a physical key like we unlock our doors with, or something you are, that is some aspect of your body or your physical person.
Our memories are bad with passwords, and we can easily lose a key. So some researchers have turned their focus to biometrics, that is, using parts of your body as ID. Just like in the movie Minority Report.
Look at me. Positive for Howard Marks.
It's the year 2054, when a quick scan of your eyes can tell a computer who you are. Tom Cruise's character is on the run from the law, desperate to change his identity, so he finds an underground eye surgeon.
All I'm trying to tell you is that I'll have to remove your eyes completely, and I have to replace them with new ones.
Okay, this is a bit extreme, but engineering psychologist Kelly Kane says one of the main reasons why we haven't seen a wide use of biometrics instead of passwords is...
Your credentials, so your face or your iris or your fingerprint, can't be reissued if they get compromised.
So Ed Felton says the best way to protect your digital identity is using multiple layers of security with passwords.
The familiar passwords are not perfect. They're far from perfect, but they are the easiest alternative for now.
That means for the time being, passwords are here to stay. Of course, you can always go with a good story. Just make sure it doesn't involve jogging, forests, or squirrels. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Having a strong password is essential, but there are still all sorts of ways your computer can get hacked. We talked last week about phone hacking with Christopher Segoyan, and he's back now to talk about computer security. Segoyan's a graduate fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University, and he's here with me in the studio. Glad you're back with us again.
Thanks for bringing it back.
Christopher, it seems like there is a hacking story in the news every day, and we're hoping that you can help people wade through this and figure out how to protect themselves. Where are people most vulnerable? Is it through their Wi-Fi network service? Is it through the online purchases they make? Is it through email?
Many of the vulnerabilities that consumers face are due to the services that they're using. So, for example, many of the services like Facebook, Twitter, Yahoo, don't use strong encryption when you're logging in. And so what that means is that if you're logging in from your home connection and there's a password on your Wi-Fi network, you're fine. But if you're at Starbucks or your school or library and there's an open Wi-Fi network, anyone sitting nearby you who's using the right software on their laptop can actually pick out your information as it goes over the air. Now, they're not going to get your password, but they're going to get something similar that will let them log in to your Facebook account, to your Yahoo or Hotmail account, as you look through your old messages, send new messages, this kind of thing.
So they're not necessarily in your email, but they're grabbing the information as it's en route?
They're not only getting the messages as they go by, but they're actually getting access to your account. So 2 hours after you've left the coffee shop. They can log in still as you, peruse old messages and send new ones. It's a really big problem.
How do you protect yourself from that?
You need to use services that have decided to put your security first. So, for example, Google has opted to use this encryption by default. So if you're a Google user and you're logging into your Gmail account, you can log in from wherever you want and you're safe. Unfortunately, Yahoo and Microsoft have not chosen security by default. Microsoft at least offers an option that you can seek out, but it's a little bit obscure. Likewise, Facebook and Twitter have what's called an SSL option that you can enable in your settings, but you have to sort of be a little bit of a geek to even know that it exists in the first place.
And maybe I'm not a little bit of a geek, because when you said SSL, it went right by me. What's that mean?
That's the term for the lock icon that you see in your browser. What it means is that everything that's transmitted between your browser and the remote website is encrypted. If you don't see the lock icon, it means that your information is being transmitted in the clear, and anyone with the right tool can just pick it out from the air.
If you're trying to protect yourself from spyware or malware, or if you have some sort of virus protection system, are they all created equally, or are some much better than others?
There are many different tools that you can use to protect yourself from spyware and malware. Many are made by the operating system vendors themselves, and so you're probably getting something for free. The important thing is that you should be updating on a regular basis. If the software tells you it's out of date, let it go and get the update. If you put it off for too long, you're going to be vulnerable and exposed to potentially malicious software on the internet.
If someone's listening to this right now and fairly spooked by this conversation, and there are three things that they can do when they go home tonight, what would those three things be?
Install all your security updates, make sure your browser is up to date, install some online backup software, and take a deep breath.
Thank you very much.
Good to talk to you again, Chris.
That's Christopher Segoyan. He's a graduate fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. He's based here in Washington, D.C.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD, as well as an online savings account and a money market account. Learn more at allybank.com.
This is NPR News.